توی کوچه رقصیدن، برای ترسیدن به وقت بوسیدن، برای خواهرم، خواهرت، خواهرامون، برای
سلام. In the name of the God of Rainbows, welcome to Woman, Life, Freedom, All In on Iran, a podcast series in which we'll go deep in conversations with experts on various aspects of the revolutionary uprising that began in Iran in September when 22-year-old Mahsa Jina Amini was killed in morality police detention. In each episode, we'll unpack an important aspect of the unfolding of this historic moment in Iran. I'm your host, Nahid Siamdous, an assistant professor of media and Middle East studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Our intention is to, quote-unquote, archive the important insights of our experts here and now, both in their capacity as professional observers, as well as humans living through these momentous times. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome to a special student edition of the Woman Life Freedom podcast, broadcast to you right from here at the University of Texas at Austin. Today we're honoring the second anniversary of the uprising. This episode will be the last in our series as we're launching a digital resource on the uprising from here and at the University of Texas as we transform the podcast series into a more general topic one. More on that exciting development soon. But for now, here we have succeeding segments by the first cohort of undergraduate students contributing to the digital resource on Iran's Woman Life Freedom Uprising. The students have independently and on their own chosen to highlight one aspect of the movement. Without further ado, I'm going to pass it on to the first group of students for their contribution to the podcast. Take it away.
Today we're going to start with Mahsa, a young Kurdish-Iranian woman who was brutally killed by Iran's morality police in 2022 for allegedly breaking the law about Islamic dress code, specifically veiling. Her death ignited a global outcry and a wave of protests. Zan Zendegi Azadi, also known as Woman Life Freedom, has become a call for justice, human rights, and freedom from oppression. Commemorating the second anniversary of Mahsa Jina Amini's murder, 34 political prisoners in Iran went on a hunger strike to honor the martyrs of the Woman Life Freedom Movement. The cutting off of one's hair may seem like a small act, one that one does maybe twice a year, or whenever one wants to change their look. But in the context of Iran and its veiling law, it became a statement, a show of civil disobedience, a statement showing that they reject the laws that are being imposed on women's bodies, a statement that personal autonomy cannot be governed by an oppressive regime. The cutting of hair is a form of protest that is so deeply rooted in Iranian culture, where cutting hair is associated historically with mourning. In the streets of Tehran, Shiraz, Isfahan, and cities all over the globe, women stood together, scissors in hand, cutting off their hair in public spaces. Videos and images went viral of women cutting their hair off as a form of protest and to honor those who have been killed, harassed, beaten, arrested, just for the act of living freely. Civil disobedience is used every day because it works. It works without the use of violence. In the case of Iranian women, the simple act of cutting one's hair became a revolutionary act, a silent yet loud outcry against a regime that has policed personal autonomy. In so many cultures, hair holds deep significance, a symbol of beauty, power, faith, or even identity. In Iran, it became a battleground. This act of civil disobedience not only brought the world's attention to Iran, but it showed how personal a form of protest could be. It was about reclaiming agency over one's body. Men even joined in solidarity, shaving their heads to support the women in their lives and stand against a system of oppression. From Tehran to Austin, Texas, women in the diaspora cut their hair in solidarity with Iranian women, capturing that civil disobedience does not have borders, that this uprising knows no borders and stands in solidarity with women anywhere and everywhere that face misogyny and oppression.
Another form of civil disobedience that took place that also is strongly connected to women reclaiming agency over their bodies was the removal of the hijab on a mass scale. Women of all socioeconomic backgrounds shed the hijab in protest of the killing of Mahsa Amini. The removal of the hijab was truly revolutionary because for that many women to take off their hijab in protest was just unprecedented. And the government couldn't arrest them all. And in just the span of a couple years, the country went from the murder of Mahsa Amini for not wearing the quote-unquote proper hijab to unveiled women in the streets. Now, granted, the morality police are still very much alive and active, and there's definitely a risk in leaving the home without a hijab. But for that many women to collectively take on that risk shows how social change really does lie in the hands of the people. And now kind of zooming out a bit, I want to talk about how the removal of the hijab shows how the ideas of revolution and social justice within Iran have really changed over the last decade or so, especially since the Green Revolution. Fatemeh Shems, an Iranian scholar living in exile, I think she articulated this point really well in an interview. She said that in the Green Revolution in the 2009 area, there was still some hope that the system could be reformed. But within the Woman Life Freedom Movement, the removal of the hijab, among other forms of civil disobedience, is just an outright rejection of that system. And Ayatollah Khomeini himself, who spearheaded the 1979 revolution, said that the hijab was the essence of the Islamic revolution, that it was the essence of a new Iran. And so with that context, the removal of the hijab isn't just taking off a piece of cloth. It's rejecting all the forms of oppression that the Islamic State has perpetuated in the last 45 years. And it also shows how revolutionary sentiments within Iran have become more resolute within the last decade.
All right. I just wanted to go ahead and open up this next section talking about how art has actually related a lot to resistance movement in general, but specifically this resistance movement. Art, you know, has a very interesting relationship to violence. It's often created as a sort of reaction to catastrophic events, violent acts, in a way almost created reflexively by a people. You can look at many other big social movements, social events, revolutions, revolts. Art plays such a central role in expressing indignance, expressing, you know, anger and frustration with the way things are. I mean, in the Black Lives Matter protests that happened, you know, just a few short years ago, art played such a central role in communicating those talking points, information, and letting the world see what was happening. I just kind of want to open up talking about how censorship has sort of shaped the way that art within Iran has taken shape and how, because of censorship and because of the way that governments have so much more control over what people say now, how that has sort of shifted some of the burden of creating art in response to this for the world stage to the diaspora. And then also talking about how we are in a way now with the advent of the internet and how like social media networks are able to exist outside of authority might want it to exist, how uncensorable we are now. So I just want to talk about how art has come about in Iran specifically, and then move to the diaspora. So in Iran, a lot of the art being shared, especially after the banning of like WhatsApp and Instagram, a lot of it has to be a little bit more tongue-in-cheek. I saw several different articles talking about how like the use of traditional Iranian imagery, taking snippets of traditional poetry and using iconography that is typically associated with peace and stuff to make statements while evading accusations of association with the movement. In the wider world, there has been a much wider breadth of art created because there are less restrictions. So in terms of visual art, there are innumerable pieces being created. This is a global movement. There are many people who feel strongly about this, but a lot of Iranians in diaspora have been contributing their thoughts and their feelings and connecting this movement to not only, you know, a cry for an end to this internal oppression, but relating this movement to the struggle of women as a whole. The artist JR, who has been prolific, created a few art pieces in relation to woman life freedom, the most prominent of which being a large collage piece depicting Mahsa Amini with a large group of people protesting, sort of representing her hair. And the way this has been sort of digitally cataloged has been in aerial photography. There are many different pieces on the internet being shared. Part of how art is being proliferated now is through digital spaces. And so it's just made graphic design and digital art much more central in how the movement has related to art. There have been several different pieces that I've seen that I just want to highlight real quick. A piece by the artist Jals depicting the Azadi Tower with Matisse's dancers and the Woman Life Freedom motto emboldened on the top, combining these different elements to create a piece of art. And then Duraj Saberivant uses some traditional images of folkloric entities to sort of represent the oppression that women face in a painting depicting a protester burning their hijab surrounded by these folkloric demons. In general, I think that art has played a big part in the revolution, but music specifically is a world that, because of its sort of nonlinear nature, has been able to really express a lot of things that maybe visual art might not be able to because of censorship. I just want to briefly talk about Broya and how it has become sort of like an anthem for the revolution, and specifically what it means to the people of this uprising. It works to encapsulate what the movement means to people, talking about all the different things that people are, you know, fighting for in this uprising. And I think it's a very important piece of art.
Hi there, my name is Mordechai, and I'm a junior at the University of Texas at Austin.
Hi, my name is EE. I'm also a junior at the University of Texas at Austin.
Hi, my name is Satchel. I'm a senior at the University of Texas at Austin.
And today we'll explore social media's role in the Woman Life Freedom movement from a top-down perspective. In particular, we will begin by examining the structural and legal frameworks that shaped the movement's online presence. From Instagram to Twitter to mainstream media, we'll also analyze the roles of Iranians inside the country, the diaspora, and non-Iranians in shaping discursive commentary and influencing global perceptions of Iranian Muslim women and Muslim women more broadly. After the 1979 revolution, the newly established Islamic Republic combined religious confessional law called Sharia law into a theocratic system based on the theory of velayat-e-faqih, guardianship of the jurist, in the absence of the Mahdi. Under this guiding principle, which underlies the very structure of the Islamic Republic, all laws have to comply with the Ja'fari school of Twelver Shi'i Islamic jurisprudence. This underlying merger between religion and state influences both criminal and civil law, as well as administrative regulations and executive enforcement at national and provincial levels. In particular, this institutionalization of religion underlies the Woman Life Freedom Movement's grievances against the Iranian state, along with class, ethnic, and religious intersectionality. The Gasht-e-Irshad, or Morality Police, was officially established in the 1990s following the Iran-Iraq War, though the enforcement of Islamic dress codes began shortly after the 1979 revolution, when head coverings for women were mandated, along with modest dress. Initially informal, these regulations became increasingly organized, especially after Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's presidency in the mid-2000s, with further intensification under the administration of Ebrahim Raisi. The morality police were tasked with enforcing Islamic laws, particularly concerning dress and behavior in public spaces, such as co-ed spaces where males and females are in close proximity. We see this in the infamous photo from September 2022 of two Iranian women unveiled eating breakfast at a Tehrani cafe.
The Gasht-e-Irshad, the morality police's authority, extends beyond regulating hijabs. They also detain individuals for violations such as wearing tight or revealing clothing, torn jeans, or for participating in mixed-gendered gatherings. Enforcements can vary based on the political climate, religious holidays, and election periods, as seen in heightened crackdowns during these times. Despite the structural presence of the morality police, public resistance to their mandate has persisted, with many Iranian women subtly challenging these regulations in their daily lives, often pushing the boundaries of what is permissible. It's important to note that within pushing these boundaries, social media engagement is very high in Iran, and people live out their lives on the internet as well as in the physical world to a high extent, creating parallel private lives that are starkly different from their public ones expressed in the physical realm.
And we see this especially in the younger generation. We see such a massive presence on social media where they're communicating or sharing sides of themselves that may not have an outlet otherwise. Part of this climate of social pressure has a lot to do with the morality police, as we mentioned before.
The morality police represent a visible symbol of the state's enforcement of Islamic law, and the wider movement seeks to address deeper issues within the structure of the Islamic Republic itself. The enforcement is seen as part of a broader system of social and political control that extends beyond the morality police. Notably, even the idea of hijab itself, its contours, and its outer meanings are not a solidified concrete idea. There's a fair bit of gray area in how individual Iranian women and Muslim women more broadly navigate ideas of hijab and modesty more broadly.
The legality of hijab is contested, and the looseness of the legal definition causes various interpretations of what modesty looks like, both from a legal perspective and confessional slash individual religious thought. This gray area leads to rampant abuses of power from the state and its morality police, the Gasht-e-Irshad. Most morality officers are conservative men, although sometimes women are also part of the morality police. These definitions of modesty can range greatly from person to person.
As mentioned, Women Life Freedom is not a secular movement, nor is it an attack on Islam or hijab. Women Life Freedom is a revolution that argues for autonomy, agency, and human rights at its core to express oneself in public, whether veiled or unveiled, and not have to fear for your life. Nor is the Women Life Freedom movement simply a Western-style mainstream feminist movement. The tangible repercussions of this violent, oppressive crackdown on women's bodies and rights are another stage for the state's demonstration of power. That's why social media has been so important. There's been a massive outcry across the globe among those that have been displaced or otherwise immigrated as a part of the diaspora. But the Women Life Freedom movement becoming a popular movement on the world stage does have drawbacks, a major one being the distortion or even co-opting by Western feminism.
I'm Casey. I'm a junior international relations and global studies major, and I'm 20 years old.
Hi, I'm Nick Hatzadeq. I'm a senior international relations and global studies student.
I'm Hatcher. I'm a senior at UT Austin, and I'm 21. So today we'd like to talk about, within the broader context of women, life, freedom in Iran, religiosity, mandatory hijab. We want to kind of explain how the concept of hijab isn't always tied intimately to a piece of cloth that you wear, but more so a concept. We're going to be talking about different interpretations of hijab that you may not be aware of.
Yeah, we're trying to sort of dispel the myth that the Women Life Freedom movement is about the hijab as much as it's more just about a lack of choice for Iranian women.
And of course, with hijab in mind, we definitely will be covering how religion in and of itself has been instrumentalized by the regime in Iran.
So first, I think it would be helpful to explain some context for Women Life Freedom and modern Iran. So we're going to start with some statistics for arrests for female demonstrators.
In 2023, there were 853 reported executions in Iran. That was a 48% increase from 2022 and a 172% increase from 2021. At least 545 of these executions were for charges that under international law do not call for execution. They are overly harsh punishments and 7 have been reportedly killed specifically in relation to the Women Life Freedom movement. This huge surge in execution rates has a lot to do with current draconic drug laws, but it also has a lot to do with the Iranian government cracking down in response to the Women Life Freedom movement and trying to overassert its control on the Iranian people.
Right. And so maybe a specific example of that would be Nesrin Sotoudeh, who is a Iranian attorney, and she's actually defended multiple female demonstrators from Revolution Street that, you know, were famously seen waving a piece of white cloth or a hijab while standing on a utility box. Many were jailed, and she defended some of them. In a writing she published, she explains that in her defense, she argues legally that hijab is not always a tangible piece of cloth, but in her own words, she says that it depends on the context of a situation. On the other end of things, the governmental interpretation within the legal system interprets hijab very narrowly, which Sotoudeh explains goes against legal precedents across the world, not just in Iran or the West or wherever you might think. So we can see here like a microcosm of the regime interpreting things or taking a stance on things that does not rely on justice, but instead makes women into a tool of exercising power. You know, more specifically, to demonstrate this, we can see women are not just arrested for not veiling, you know, their hair, but if they wear clothing that is too bright, too colorful, or sometimes described as flowery, they're jailed. This is, in many places, an obscene abuse of power. We can see that this result can be traced back to changes in religiosity within Iran post-revolution.
Just a little bit of context for the sort of general feelings of religiosity in Iran. It's hard to precisely define. I would encourage you to do more reading, but as just sort of a brief overview, the 1979 revolution against the Shah had a very far traditional religious lean. And the reasoning for this is that after the 1953 coup of Mohammad Mossadegh, the Shah was very fiercely aligned with the Western bloc, and a lot of his policies and reforming ideas put a lot of pressure and were very swift on the traditional Iranian society. This caused a lot of economic troubles. It oppressed a lot of the religious class. And because of it, people started conflating Western ideas, things like feminism and things like that, with Western interference in Iran. And because of that, they leaned very far in the other direction. It's very easy to say that that is a failing on their part, that they went too traditional, but without understanding the context of the oppression they were facing under the Shah and the over-enforcement of Western ideals, you can't really understand where this sort of intense religiosity came from and why the Iranian people supported it initially in the beginning, even though now sentiments are very different.
That is definitely true. And as we can see, right post-revolution, Iranian government basically used religion as this tool to basically legitimize itself across the Iranian territory. And now going back into the wider context of religion in and of itself, we can see that within Iran, religion is definitely used as a tool to impose government regulation across the community. And of course, that would mean there would be opposition to it, though it is important to note that the most notable criticism, especially one that's centered within this movement, isn't that in regards to religion itself. It's not against Islam. The main sentiment isn't that, oh, Islam shouldn't be a thing, or that it's rather the human agency, the human dignity. And of course, there are calls for secularization and stuff, and there's definitely room to speak of that. However, it is important to note that this is a human rights movement and not one that specifically directly speaks against a religion. And also with how the Iranian government tries to impose this, it goes beyond the formal institutions that they would have. So aside from the government regulated pressure that is imposed, there's also a public incentive to make the community conform to it. Although I would say, and you guys could correct me if I'm wrong, this is not necessarily the case, not the majority of people would do, but the very concept of Amr Bimaruf and Nahy Munkar, just an idea to kind of discipline the community in and of itself, the incentive to make people and with good intentions to push them in the right sorts and the right way and right path. It's also a way that solidifies that religion being used as a tool and instrument that we talked about earlier, because this is used as a justification, not necessarily just for how the Iranian government goes about providing a specific framework within which the population has to adjust to and adhere to, but it also uses this specific concept and the very religion as a justification for the regime's whole conduct and for the communal and societal self-censoring, for observing one another's presentation and their behavior and the very public existence and even private existence at the moment within the boundaries of what the Islamic Republic deems fit. So the very fact that the religion grounds are used as a justification, it's bound to create this impression that people are lesser religious, because then in return, for example, hijab being part of religion, women are taking off their hijab and burning it. This is to signify that they have the agency to choose for themselves. This also creates an incentive for you to be lesser religious in public and all of that. But yeah, it speaks to how religion is used in this specific context, and it often dilutes the whole conversation where it goes against, oh, so you're against Islam, and suddenly the whole conversation revolves around that one concept when it goes way, way deeper than that.
No, you're 100% right. And I think that the Islamic regime, that's what they want people to argue about. They want this to be a religious debate. This is not a religious debate. This is not a religious movement. This isn't the Iranian people trying to throw away Islam. This is a lack of agency. This is a lack of choice that Iranian women are suffering under. It's really unfortunate that they are using religion, which is quite a personal thing and quite a cultural thing, as a tool of political control.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say, even not just specifically in the context of Iran, but even in the broader sense, women have always been unfortunately, the most visible means of exercising political authority over civilians, which is quite unfortunate. Historically speaking, women have always been made an example of, from the very way that they dress, that would be a means to signal the establishment and all, but also to how they adhere to religious norms. I mean, Afghanistan is a great example of that. As an Afghan, I can speak to it that this is quite a frustrating situation. In Afghanistan specifically, same thing in Iran, the way the Shah unveiled his wife, and that was a symbolic of secular movement. Amanullah Shah in Afghanistan did practically the same thing, and look where that got us. Taliban, first round, they got in there, they executed a woman in a football field. Look where that got us. Right now, women aren't allowed to be heard or seen in public in Afghanistan. Look where that has us. So anyways, it's quite a frustrating conversation. Unfortunately, women have always been made an example of. And Dr. Siam Dost had a great quote in her 2022 article in the New Lines magazine. I really like that, where you basically said the male dominant rulers and governments often treated women's bodies as theaters of identity politicking, which I fully agree with. It's always been a signifier of an era, politically, socially, whatever it may be. Unfortunately, when it comes to minorities, of course, there would be intersections of identities. For example, in the case of Mahsa Amini, we could speak to her ethnic identity as a Kurdish Iranian woman. Unfortunately, that very fact that women are the symbol of it. So it's quite symbolic to see how they're the ones who are also the face of this whole movement.
To leave you guys with something so that you don't have the impression that this is an isolated news story and that it's over and done with, because we're using dates that occurred in 2021, 22, and 23. This is an ongoing issue, and in fact, it's increased in intensity and severity. Amnesty International has reported that women in public seen unveiled or not abiding by Islamic law by the regime are being kidnapped into vans by the state police. They are being tortured with electric shocks. They are being sexually abused by the state. So I just want to leave you with the impression that this is ongoing. It's an increasingly deteriorating status of women in Iran on the basis of political tool. As Nick had said, this politicking is not going anywhere anytime soon.
My name is Matthew Montiel. I'm a senior at UT Austin.
My name is Asal Khirs. I'm a 19-year-old student at the University of Texas.
So imagine living in a country where, on top of fighting for your rights, you also struggle to afford basic things like food and medicine. That's the reality for many in Iran today. International sanctions placed on Iran attempt to inhibit the development of successful nuclear, missile, and advanced weapons programs. But they have made life for Iranian citizens harder than ever before. Among those affected are the women of Iran, who are not only fighting a battle for freedom, but due to the economic pressure of the sanctions, struggle to afford basic necessities such as food and medicine. Are these sanctions imposed on Iran an unequivocal aspect of U.S. national security, or do the disproportionate effects on women prompt further discussion?
So sanctions have definitely caused like a shortage of essential goods and increased inflation, which obviously affects everybody, but especially women in the Women Life Freedom Movement who are standing up and protesting. This could either motivate them more and draw them in to protest for either food and stuff that they can't afford on top of their rights and having to battle constantly the morality police and all of that, or it could either just draw them back and say, well, there is not enough health care. We don't even know if we get hurt, if something happens, we don't even know if we'll be able to afford something like that. And like that puts them at even more risk.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. You know, following former President Trump kind of backing out of the Iranian nuclear deal, this kind of tanked the economy, you know, by reinstating all those sanctions that were kind of lifted before the deal. So it kind of threw so many people and kind of businesses under the line.
Yeah.
Because they just couldn't afford food. They couldn't afford supplies, you know, because so many things, just the prices just skyrocketed.
Right.
Like you said, which is a great point, you know, this kind of pushed so many more women and just citizens in general and society in general into protest and into kind of turmoil because,
right,
you know, they couldn't afford anything due to these sanctions. With these sanctions that kind of bring so many new people into the protest and kind of almost bolster motivation among people to protest and to join the Women's Life Freedom Movement, how have women specifically suffered and how has the freedom movement suffered and has faced setbacks, you know, in itself?
Right. So I think that the freedom movement has kind of been, in a way, kind of overshadowed by people that are also protesting because of poverty and all of this. It kind of takes away from the whole point of like women not having enough rights and women literally battling these police who are constantly telling them to put their hijab on and all of this and them not having the personal freedom to do absolutely anything, basically. And people who are battling poverty and also joining these protests, of course, it adds to the movement of, and of course, like that's a whole situation in itself. But I think that it definitely has some point. It's like, it's cut to a point where it's like a little bit of just overshadowing the whole movement as a whole.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's a great point. You know, especially thinking about kind of like the U.S. strategy towards these sanctions, which is, you know, what they call maximum pressure,
right?
Which just involves putting pressure on the entirety of Iranian society. Well, I guess more specifically, or who's affected by this most would be the middle class. And like, right, you said, this kind of one disproportionately affects women, you know, hinders their ability to access medical supplies and food. But it also kind of, like you said, overshadows the rest of the political movement because, yeah, people are now upset, you know, they're getting violent, they're disorganized, and it undermines,
right,
an organized women's freedom movement and, yeah, kind of hinders its ability to make any progress.
Yeah. And obviously when people are flooding the streets and protesting, that causes shops to shut down. And there are shops that people can't run their businesses because of the protests. And that in itself causes a lot of political or economic damage. And that also adds to the overshadowing of the movement, I think.
Yeah. And like adding to that, like the thing that makes these sanctions very dangerous is that they don't target a nuclear program specifically. They target the entities that support the nuclear program, steel production, the manufacturers that create all the milling materials and kind of like all these other smaller entities that produce the pieces that go and make up a nuclear program. All these dual-use products now are inaccessible to citizens who may need them.
Right.
While it's also being inaccessible to the nuclear program. Right.
And that's also pushing women into like silence because of that economic mm-hmm. pressure. And there are people who are obviously thinking, what if I can't go protest because I have kids and I can't even afford things for myself? And if something happens to me because of the protesting and because of all the morality police on the streets, or just in general, not even women just protesting, but walking the streets, the fear of them not having their quote unquote hijab on properly. If something were to happen to them with this economic pressure, it's just so much, so stressful for them.
Yeah. And I guess just kind of like a closing question that we can kind of pose to ourselves and not only those listening to this. So following the sanctions and reimposed by former President Trump in 2018, the GDP of Iran dropped almost $100 billion within the next 2 years. This is obviously what some would call a successful campaign against Iran's nuclear programs and weapons programs. But is this worth the disproportionate effects that are faced by women and the Women Life Freedom Movement? Or is this just necessary evil, collateral damage?
Right. I mean, obviously, like, a big question to say, like, are these the sanctions imposed if it's, like, a necessary trade-off and if it's just doing more damage than good? Mm-hmm. But these women, they're struggling. They're struggling really bad, and poverty rates have doubled. And in my opinion, personally, I do not think it's worth it that these women are struggling mm-hmm. this hard for both their freedoms and then on top of that, the economic hardships that they're going through. They don't know what to do. I mean, mm-hmm. it's the economic pressure is absolutely crushing them.
Yeah. Well, we can only hope that in the future, the U.S. reevaluates its sanctions, the international community reevaluates their sanctions and figure out a way to find balance between supporting the Women's Life Freedom Movement and ensuring the safety of national security.
2 years have passed since the murder of Mahsa Jina Amini, and still the movement has a great deal of momentum, with women cutting their hair, taking off their hijab, and fighting in whatever ways they can. These are all a reminder that civil disobedience, even in the simplest form and most personal form, can start an uproar. As we remember Mahsa today, we honor all those who have used civil disobedience to stand against injustice and fight for freedom, because all it takes is one act to start a revolution.
You were listening to an episode of Woman, Life, Freedom, All In on Iran, broadcast to you from the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host, Nahid Siamdust. Until next time, Zhinjiyan Azadi, Zan Zendegi Azadi.